Saturday in the Waters and Carpenter Bookstore.
Independent Bookseller Day.
How do you feel about that?
Store-wide sales. Deep discounts.
Deep discounts.
We cut our throat
I feel
make
like
you happy.
Independent Bookseller Day, you should jack the prices up. Everything should be twice the price. Yeah, right. You didn't even make any money last year, you said.
Subsidize. Oh, that was a rough one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you're going to have to be a not-for-profit.
Mm-hmm. Pay myself a big salary. Yeah, so you got Richard Feynman in your hand there.
Yep. Yeah, thanks again, man. So what do you think of this year's Writers' Festival, Will?
I think that there was some good reading.
Yeah.
And, of course, Saturday night, Leslie Leake was just fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she just...
I'm pretty sure she hates me.
She just lit it up. Well, she hates me, too. So, but she just lit it up, and... no, it was great, and... it could be my last year. I think I'm just going to have to tell the young people around here for the next year, you guys, I'll help you. Somebody's got to set up a monthly poetry reading, write prose reading, and start, because that's how it works. You got to have monthly readings just to get the community together, feel who's there, right?
Is that what it's about? It's about community? Because if it's about community, I think all writers, or most writers, are pretty terrible at this. Like, that's what I tried to do with mine. I was like, okay, look, I'm not going to try it. Because there was that one girl that one night, she came up, she just waits, reads her thing, and leaves. You know, and to me, that seems like what so many writers are doing. They're just, mm-hmm. like, standing around waiting to read their thing so they mm-hmm. can leave. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then, well, you know.
If they're good, I don't care.
But how good do you have to be for that to be valid? I think you have to be pretty fucking good. I think you have to be pretty...
Well, and they rarely are. I agree completely. Yeah. The most generous people I knew were the best writers. The only ones that ever bought my books were better writers than me. Mm. It was astonishing. You know? Like, I mean, it was just amazing. You know, we used to go down to Logan and Salt Lake. And I'd be selling books, and it would always be like the coolest people, the best writers would buy my books, everybody else. But anyway, that's what I'm kind of, I don't think I'm going to do it next year. I'm going to try and develop in the next year, I'm going to try and get these people who come in here and want to read and say, okay, look, I'll help you get it started.
What do they sound like when they say they want to read? Like, I'm trying to go back now. To before being jaded, to before being disillusioned with the idea of anyone giving a shit about me reading in front of them. Like, what are they, like, well, I'm just impressed with you that you can still find authenticity in it. I don't know. To me, it's...
Well, that's the point. I mean, that's what you try. It takes a lifetime to become authentic. But you got to start somewhere, and
that's true.
And the only thing that readings do is that, you know, again, I invited myself to read Friday night, and I read the first chapter of my last novel that will soon be published, and I couldn't believe it, man. Just reading it live and penciling out. I mean, I just trimmed it in. I mean, that first chapter is great now. I love it.
So you got. I mean,
it's a different psychological thing when you go through four or five pages of prose and read it like you're gonna read it live.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you just see all the places you gotta keep the rhythm right. You know, just gotta, or what doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's astonishing how it changes your psychology, changes your perception of your work when you suddenly start, okay, this has got to sound good, right?
Yeah.
So that's the essential. That's the important thing. That's why you have to have readings, and you're right. The community is secondary.
Or, to me, it would be compelling if it was the most important thing. But with writers, like, I remember reading an interview of this one lady, and she was like, yeah, writers make terrible company in general. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I guess I haven't really, other than you, I don't really hang out with that many other writers. But speaking of things,
I can say that musicians can be funnier if they're the musicians that are in my band, and these guys got PhDs. You know, they're all funny, well-educated people, you know, and they're all old, and so they just want to be funny in the end. What are you going to say, something that's funny? Or something that makes sense. And they tolerate me because I'm always stodgily saying, look, you...
Wait, hold on. Back up. Things that are funny don't make sense?
The musicians I hang out with are always just trying to be funny. Where somebody like me is trying to say something that makes sense. Like last night, this brilliant musician... young guy though, and he plays this song that is a knockoff of the Grateful Dead, right? Uh-huh. I know you, right, are gonna miss me when I'm gone, right? And he's put a montage of different lyrics from different songs together, and one of them is "Drink muddy water and sleep in a hollow log." Drink muddy water, sleep in a hollow log. Than to stay around here and be treated like a dog. Well, I mean, he puts it in there, and I'm fine with all that, but at the end, while everybody else is saying funny things, I say, hey, look, man, Skip James wrote that line. You have to acknowledge Skip James, because he was one of the greatest Mississippi Delta blues singers ever. And you're just fucking throwing that line in to make your song cute, you know? So anyway, everybody looks at me, okay, well, are you through? And then they start making jokes again. And I'm totally fine with that, man. I mean, I really am.
Well, that's an interesting crossover.
But that's the writer. See, I'm a writer. They're not writers.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's important that, no, come on, Skip James. And then I played the way he played it. Yeah, and it was just totally different, you know. I mean, it's like... Second line is, when your knee bones get aching and your body feeling cold. Your knee bones get aching and your body feeling cold. You're just getting ready for some cypress grove. You know, like that? That's the tone of those two lines, those two couplets or whatever. Uh-huh. Not this high, like... You know, Jingle Django, you know, happy song, man, you know. So I had to tell them that, and they all just kind of shake their head and go, okay, well, it's your place. We'll put up with your shit. But for most, because they just want to make jokes, man. So I'm with them all the way.
They just want to have fun, you know.
They just want to have fun, man.
Vibe and have fun. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have so many questions about music at the end of the day.
So we are doing a shout out for the new Deschutes Variety Pack, which has a couple of older ones, but Jonah just handed me Modern Revival IPA. So we're hoping Deschutes will give us a promotional package pretty soon.
I think we need about 10,000 more listeners before that happens. God damn.
Okay, Richard Feynman.
Richard Feynman.
And the reason you like him is he takes phonies to task with such mathematical precision.
Yeah. Well, also, it's, you know, just like his other book, The Pleasure of Finding Things Out. Well, to me, that's what reading was. Reading right. was the pleasure of finding things out, right. Even if it was a subtle character detail or just like being like, oh, that's a recognition I have of myself. This is something I can recognize in myself, and thusly I'm finding out that this wasn't strange. Like, this is a pretty basic human thing or way to think about the world or whatever. But Feynman, you know, he consistently gets to take people to task and be above it, which is, you know, it's a very, very alluring. It's and maybe too much so. As I said when I tried to do the first intro, I think he's damaged me in a certain sense of, you know, he is just talking, and he didn't really write this so much as just spoke the stories to someone else and then they punched it all up later, and that to me is very alluring. It is a very alluring style for unlike other writers we've talked about, he's not a writer, so it's hard for me to put into words.
Well, you know, you got to remember there's polemical writing and there's creative writing. And it's if you're writing polemics, you want to somehow either pay you to record you or figure out how to get that flow of polemical, you know, superiority going. I mean, nobody wants a modest person, you know, savaging somebody else. They want somebody that says, yeah, I mean, this guy's a real dickhead, man. I'm gonna tell you why. I mean,
but still manages to make a point along the way.
Well, you know, you cannot be equanimous when you're tearing apart a phony. You know, you just, let's get to it, man. You know, he doesn't deserve, this person or woman does not deserve, you know, equal treatment. So I'm just gonna tell you what a dickhead she is. Is dickhead an oxymoron for a woman?
Oxymoron?
Yeah. It's just inappropriate.
Well, I mean...
Well, we associate dicks with men, that's what I was saying.
Yeah. Well, I think dickhead just means, what, they've got a tall head? They've just got a large forehead?
No, it's got a Corolla.
Yeah, Corolla on top. Yeah. In which case wouldn't be an insult for someone who actually had that. You'd be like, wow, that's actually really interesting. And,
like a dinosaur.
Yeah. I wish I knew a better way to, like, I got excited for doing this book, and then, you know, I've had to go back to doing a full-time job, so I don't just get to, like, sit around and think about it all the time. Mm-hmm. But even though I've been reading it and enjoying reading it, I'm just going to read some of it. So anyone who's never read Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman will get a sense of it. The reason why I say I'm uncultured or anti-intellectual probably goes all the way back to the time when I was in high school. I was always worried about being a sissy. I didn't want to be too delicate. To me, no real man ever paid any attention to poetry and such things. How poetry ever got written, that never struck me. So I developed a negative attitude toward the guy who studies French literature or studies too much music or poetry, all these fancy things. I admired better the steel worker, the welder, or the machine shop man. I always thought the guy who worked in the machine shop and could make things, now he was a real guy. That was my attitude. To be a practical man was, to me, always somehow a positive virtue, and to be cultured or intellectual was not. The first was right, of course, but the second was crazy. I still had this feeling when I was doing my graduate study at Princeton. As you'll see, I used to eat often in a nice little restaurant called Papa's Place. One day, while I was eating there, a painter in his painting clothes came down from an upstairs room. He'd been painting and sat near me. Somehow we struck up a conversation and he started talking about how you've got to learn a lot to be in the painting business. For example, he said, in this restaurant, what colors would you use to paint the walls if you had to do the job? I said I didn't know, and he said, you have a dark band up to such and such a height because you see people who sit at the tables rub their elbows against the walls, so you don't want a nice white wall. There, it gets dirty too easily. But above that, you do want it white to give a feeling of cleanliness to the restaurant. The guy seemed to know what he was doing, and I was sitting there hanging on to his words, what he said. And you also have to know about colors, how to get different colors when you mix the paint. For example, what colors would you mix to get yellow? I didn't know how to get yellow by mixing paint. If it's light, you mix green and red, but I knew he was talking about paints. So I said, I don't know how you get yellow without using yellow. Well, he said, if you mix red and white, you'll get yellow. Are you sure you don't mean pink? No, he said, you'll get yellow. And I believe that he got yellow because he was a professional painter. And I always admired guys like that. But I still wondered how he did it. I got an idea. It must be some kind of chemical change. We're using some kind of special pigments that make a chemical change. No, he said, any old pigments will work. You go down to the 5 and cent and get some paint. Just a regular can of red paint and a regular can of white paint. And I'll mix them and I'll show you how to get yellow. At this juncture, I was thinking, something is crazy. I know enough about paints to know you won't get yellow. But he must know that you do get yellow. And therefore, something interesting happens. I've got to see what it is. So I said, okay, I'll get the paints. The painter went back upstairs to finish his painting job, and the restaurant owner came over and said to me, what's the idea of arguing with that man? The man is a painter. He's been a painter all his life. And he says he gets yellow. So why argue with him? I felt embarrassed. I didn't know what to say. Frankly, I said, all my life I've been studying light, and I think that with red and white, you can't get yellow. You can only get pink. So they went to the 5 and 10 and got the paint and brought it back to the restaurant. The painter came down from upstairs and the restaurant owner was there too. I put the cans of paint on an old chair and the painter began to mix the paint. He put a little more red. He put a little more white. It still looked pink to me. And he mixed some more. Then he mumbled something like, oh, I used to have a little tube of yellow here to sharpen it up a bit. And this will be yellow. Oh, I said, of course. You add yellow and you can get yellow. But you couldn't do it without the yellow. The painter went back upstairs to paint. The restaurant owner said, that guy has his nerve, arguing with a guy who studied light all his life. But that shows you how much I trusted these real guys. The painter had told me so much stuff that was reasonable that I was ready to give him a certain chance.
Yeah.
There was an odd phenomenon I didn't know.
Yeah,
I was expecting pink, but I've very often made mistakes in my physics by thinking the theory isn't as good as it really is, thinking there are lots of complications that are going to spoil it. An attitude that anything can happen in spite of what you're pretty sure should happen.
Beautiful.
And yet he still, you know, he acknowledges that attitude. And
it's the bait and switch. You know, people will give you something as valid, and then they'll just switch on you, and you know, and then it's totally wrong. But you're set up for it, you know. You think, well, historically, they've been correct, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man.
Well, it's also that dealing with uncertainty.
Well, that's the thing. And the world throws you these feints, you know. It'll give you the real stuff, or then it'll just kind of like faint something, and you go with it, and now you're screwed up, man. Now you're out of step, and yeah, it's just the whole thing of uncertainty, man. Phenomenology is all about uncertainty.
And he's, I mean, he also gets to be this kind of mythologized figure, and anything he tries to do, he seems to get good at it.
Of course.
Like, as soon as he starts drawing, he sticks his mind to it, and he becomes good. Mm-hmm. He becomes good at it. And that's one of my, I mean, the whole reason I ended up writing that strip club article was because of this book and the little throwaway
really?
About how Feynman would go sit in strip clubs for his afternoon lunch, and he was practicing drawing. So people, this owner of a massage parlor saw one of the drawings he did for the strip club owner guy, and he commissions him to do it, and it's of He gets to brag about, he does this Roman slave girl with one exposed breast over a toga massaging like an important Roman senator. And he's like, and you know what? I nailed the resignation in her face exactly correct. You know, he understands physics, he understands science.
And human also, beings too, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And,
It's hard to be one of the brightest men on earth. You know, it's just hard. And to be fearless, too. That was the other thing about him, you know.
Well, you bump up against these boundaries where if you are that bright, it'd be pretty hard to not be constantly second-guessing yourself, because there are just a bunch of people. And like I was talking about, the one where he's going to this ethics of education conference where, you know, people just talk a lot of nonsense because they don't know what the question is. They don't know the question they're trying to solve.
Right.
And for him, that was...
The question has been decided. And that's the question they're going to talk about. Yeah. And Feynman's saying, that's not the question at all, man. You know, and that's... But, I mean, nobody's ever, brought contrary evidence that, yeah, there'd be like 100 mathematicians and they couldn't figure this problem, and Feynman would just go in and go, boom, boom, here's this, man. You're just not looking at the right question the whole time, yeah, man. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, I'm sorry. And the thing about, you know, when his beautiful wife is dying of cancer and he stays with her, you know, and visits her every day and like loves her, you know, until she dies, man, for like 2 years. Total wisdom, man. That's what really shook me about him, man. He just always like did the right thing. And then, yeah, all those Navy brass that could get him put in the hole, man, he's figuring out how to read their codes, you know, figure out how to open their files. He's doing everything.
Cracking safes. Yeah. When he was working at Los Alamos.
He was
part of the development of the atomic bomb.
Oh, yeah.
And which, I mean, we both know, but I thought I'd express for the podcast.
And he was the only one that made sure that he did not wear dark glasses to watch it. He wanted to see it the way it was. I mean, never followed the rules, man.
I think I remember from that, he hid behind the door of the blast. He didn't wear the glasses, but he stepped behind like a...
Right, and got a refraction of it.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't reread every single one in here, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just little stuff, or... Like, even the simple things of... this one I remember because I spent so much time working in kitchens, about how he thought he could best the guys by stabbing a knife into the table and like running string beans through the knife instead of cutting them with his knife. He was just going to use it like a saw. And this is one of the times he was like, yeah, well, I realized that one was actually pretty dumb. But he has this description of the guy who's putting the doilies, like when in the old school restaurants, they'd put doilies for the desserts on the little plates. Mm-hmm. And I worked in a place like that, mm-hmm, where they'd put doilies under the French onion soup. And it was like, oh, these damn doilies. This guy with big chicken fingers and chicken fingers, sausage fingers.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just a...
Yeah.
There's a thing on the back that says he's a storyteller in the tradition of Mark Twain. It's possible to laugh out loud and scratch your head at the same time. I never scratch my head. I don't think it's that
common. Twain's always setting you up. He's a professional jokester. He's always setting you up for the punchline. I mean, he's setting the trap door for you to step into, and then he's going to... But Feynman's not that way at all. He's just a brilliant storyteller, but I don't know. You know, as you mentioned that, I was thinking, gosh, I mean, is this one of these books that people are going to be reading like 500 years from now? Because it's just so good. And his personality comes to the fore, you know? And
yeah, I mean, it's really hard to make your personality come to the fore in a authentic way that's also, yeah.
But I mean, that's the point. I mean, yeah. It's a little tiresome that he's always right. But if you are always right, it's pretty damn hard, man. You know, what are you going to do, you know? Yeah. Well, I'll just act like a dickhead, you know, for a couple of pages to show that I'm not perfect. Now, Feynman was just... And you just see him, you see pictures of him. He's always just kind of... Other people are standing straight. Feynman's always lounging against something, you know, just like Holden Caulfield, you know? He's always lounging, just kind of looking up, grinning. You know, he's always watching, and he's always part of the environment. And, you know, like me, I mean, as you know me, I just kind of... My wife said yesterday, don't you look around at people? Don't you notice people? I said, no, I go into a place to have a beer and listen. You know, I don't really notice anything. I don't make eye contact. Why should I? I'm just there, man. I don't notice anything. She was quite astounded, and you just get the feeling Fineman just kind of, it's one of these guys that just is kind of slumping against the door, listening to people, man, and just watching them, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've been bumping up into this.
Because he finds it so entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's the way learning is supposed to be. I mean, that's the reason we learn things at all. Is
the French impressionists? Observe first. Why paint something until you haven't looked at it?
Yeah.
And see how it all fits together. And not only how it fits together, how you are perceiving it as patterns in a field, right? I mean, why do any other painting? I mean, it was so revolutionary. And even after that, people still paint what they want, you know, just, you know, just like a mechanical thing, man. Yeah.
Well, there's a throwaway line in here that, like, the art of painting, unlike physics, lost its foothold when it stopped having the religious motif, when painters stopped being religious. Yeah.
Well, I agree with that completely, yeah.
Like, it lost its bearings or
right.
foregrounding, I guess you might call it. I don't know.
Right, and that's exactly right. Impressionism is all foregrounding. I was reading, I'm reading Atkinson's Man, the Invasion of Normandy, and he's got a tremendous amount of diaries from World War II veterans, and this one guy says, "Men in war, it's all foreground. It's all foreground. There's no background because you don't have time."
Right. You know? Yeah.
It's like boom, it's right there, and that's impressionism. Is it's all there. It's all foregrounding, even if it's in the background. Is the light is bringing it to you, because as you know, light moves at the speed of light, and it doesn't matter if a cloud is 10 miles away, it will be just as bright as the building right across from you, you know. And that's the brilliance of the impression.
Okay, I have two things to say.
Yes.
One, first of all, what do you think about the theoretical idea of the speed limit of light being the speed limit of the universe? Do you think that's, because I've heard physicists say they think that might not be true, that Einstein might be wrong about the, well, to the extent that it's Einstein's theory, but.
Well, see, this is where you get into the metaphysics of existence.
Good.
Why is it that the universe would be built on our perceptions of it, and are the limits of our perceptions of it? You know, that's to me what is so wonderful and spooky about everything. And Einstein's the first one that said, yeah, it's all...
Well, and that's what...
We communicate with the universe, but unfortunately for anybody that denies it, the fact that we communicate it, we are part of the universe, and we are part of the physics of the universe, and our perceptions are valid, you know? And so, yeah, I think, I mean, the speed of light is just part of what how it all works, man. You know,
I don't know if Feynman would call you a phony right there, because I'm not really sure what you said.
I thought after my second the shoots, I thought it was brilliant.
Maybe I'm just getting better at knowing you better. I'm thinking about Feynman. I'm like, huh? Well, what did he actually say?
What would Feynman? Feynman? Hey, Rick, come on down and hang out with us.
I mean, and that's one of the things that comes through in the book. I mean, well, he did stop drinking. That's one thing I did think about multiple times. There's a throwaway of it's a really simple line. He's in Brazil and he doesn't really have a lot to do, and he walks by a bar at like noon, and he thinks to himself, "Huh, it'd be nice to go in there and have a drink right now." And that thought scared him so much, he never drank again.
Hmm.
Because he's like, well, if anything can overcome my ability to take pleasure in thinking, if anything like takes control over me too much, then that is scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about that multiple times, because I've always thought, well, I you know, truth be told, I haven't thought about it in a while.
There are limits to Feynman's intelligence.
Well, yeah. Well, also, well, I'm going to circle back to my first thought, which I think is more important, which is, as you were talking, I was thinking about foregrounding in physics and how for the last basically 40 years, and physicists complain about this now, is there's not really a lot of new stuff being discovered anymore, because a lot of the technology that came out of physics discoveries, starting, you know, with the atomic bomb up through the computer age, well, now we're at computers and we are distinctly aware of the limits of those technologies. Like, you know, our social medias, the stuff that people are constantly engaging with, these are often negative qualities in people's lives. So if physics...
But that's the essence of human beings, not physics.
Well, but they only came about because people who were interested in physics and engineering and stuff invented those technologies.
I agree, but look, I was thinking about that today. Look, in the 13th century, the Germans, in the religious wars, killed several million people just with knives and axes, you know? Like, now we've got, you know, no, I was just thinking about how, look what's happening in America. I mean, our arms manufacturers have been moving guns all over Africa, Southeast Asia, da-da-da, just enabling people to butcher each other. You know, if you got a gun, you can kill somebody. So now it's coming back to America. And then I was thinking, well, that's silly, man, because you can kill a million people just with knives and pitchforks. And they did it in the 14th century.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, to conflate technology with the human spirit, because as everybody knows, you know I'm a Lutheran, right?
Right, right.
There are two Lutherans, and there's a big schism between the two. They won't even talk to each other. The first believe that Adam is just a motherfucker and there's no hope for him. And that's a conservative. And the second believe that through grace he can be saved. And that's the very liberal side. But I mean, they're still not really sure about this liberal side. Man.
Wait, wait, wait. You've talked to someone who says Adam is a motherfucker?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's no original sin, and well, human beings are just totally...
I'm imagining...
Human beings are just basically, you know, and then, you know, then you meet these saints, you know, you meet these women and men who are just saints that are so wonderful you can't believe it. And that, you know, that distracts you, but for the most part, I mean, human beings are just fucking worthless, man. I just can't, I'm so astounded now. I mean, it's the what's happening now. Give me a break, man. Human beings. Get rid of them.
This is your post-70 attitude.
Oh, no. No, I've never gone through a period like this, man. Vietnam was worse because more, you know, young Americans were dying.
Yeah.
But this is worse in terms of the moral fucking canker that's in this country, man. Jesus. I can't even believe it. There's a mass killing every fucking day in this country, man.
Yeah, but also that's like...
But anyway, let's forget this. Technology is not responsible for the human soul, man.
Yeah.
It's just the human soul cannot adapt to being able to be on Facebook or do selfies for 20 hours a day.
And actually, that's not what I was saying, really. What I was saying was it seemed like when physics, like in Richard Feynman's time, when he was dealing with physics, like the frontier, the foregrounding of what they were trying to accomplish seemed so pure and positive, just kind of unilaterally positive, like calling out people who are going to engage with something phony because and saying like, okay, well, we can prove that's not true.
Yeah. Right. But there are many scientists that end their books, the great, like Freeman Dyson. It's like when somebody says, "Oh, let's give money to this research, because there are practical applications, you know, whether in medicine or war or whatever." And he's saying, "Wait a second, let's just do research to learn stuff, you know."
Yeah.
I mean, So I mean, that's always there.
But the stuff to learn now is so complex, and like it's really hard to even understand what there is to learn in physics anymore.
No, I disagree.
Well,
I disagree, and Feynman would tell you, if you just sit down and think about it, yes, I can tell you I am self-delusional. I read these advanced quantum mechanical books. I understand every bit of it. You ask me to explain it, I go, you know, I can't explain it. But
well, that's very impressive.
But I can understand it.
Because that's Richard Feynman's quote. Yeah. If you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But I mean, I can get the dream. And like I say, you know, as you know, what, you know, English majors have over just about anybody is we've learned that it's what you see out of the corner of your eye that's cool. Mm. You know, when it's just like drawn in front of you, that's not cool, man. So I've just learned, but when I read theoretical physics, I just see it out of the corner of my eye, man. Like, I really enjoy it. And they're learning stuff all the time, man. And they're doing this cosmological stuff that's just totally out of control. And they're doing it with tools that have been designed by quantum mechanical theory in terms of space-time, you know, in terms of relativity. And it's just like astonishing. You're just going, oh my God, man. These cameras that they're building, these are all like built to the subatomic level, man. It's just like out of control.
None of them are built to the subatomic
level. Well, of course they are.
No, I mean, like, that's the dream, but none of them actively are.
No, but they are. They use those principles in terms of uncertainty and in terms of information retrieval. I'll defend this. Okay. I'm right, man.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. I'm not in that world, so I can't prove you wrong.
Well, that's good. You know, because this is how I play poker, too. That was just a bluff.
Well, it was...
But I'm right. I'm right. I'm telling you, man. It all happens because of the uncertainty principle, subatomic theory. They're able to do these information systems using these laws, man. They can work the math out. Until Feynman and his quantum thermo-quantum, anyway, the theory of heat transmission. And
yeah.
I mean, until he did that, they couldn't do this stuff, man.
So. Well, I'm not sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's always heat transfer.
Yeah. What
in all these systems, whether it's subatomic, whether it's your cell phone, it's... Information systems always have, there's always heat transfer. There's always, you know, I mean, that's how it happens.
Yeah. Now I'm worried. I'm like, oh my God. We really got to stick to literature. I can't believe I brought... Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. But give me that bottle opener back. I'm gonna be the anti Feynman. Have another beer. Good God. But what I appreciate about Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, is precisely its literary quality. You know, like, it's not deeply scientific. There's no equations in it. Like, I've tried to sit there and read, you know, physics books like about quantum mechanics, and you'll run into 10 pages that are just straight equations, and I'm like, I'm lost because I just have absolutely no training in that. I don't.
It's not too late, man. You're just a young guy. I knew a guy that went to medical school when he was 30.
Well, I'd do much better in medical school than I would becoming a mathematician. Everything I know about the physical world is, well, they say Einstein wasn't very good at math either, but, you know, that's kind of a apocryphal. But, like, it is true that physicists and mathematicians come from their very different styles of thought.
Mathematics verifies the theory. It's just weird. And again, we get into the metaphysics. The universe is metaphysical because it all is on the scale of human beings and human thought. I mean, it's really crazy when you think about it, but...
Well, I heard once that And there's a car alarm going off. Right? That a beautiful mathematical equation lights up the same region of the brain as a metaphor.
Really?
Yeah. And I've... Yeah.
In other people's brains, not ours.
Well, presuming I am able to understand...
Yes, the universal structure...
As metaphors.
Yeah, yeah, the universal structures of human, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we all got the same brain structures. But maybe not, you know, the thing that interests me, Joan, I mean, Feynman, okay, Feynman is just one thing. At my late stage of life, I'm realizing there are human beings that just are constructed differently than me. I mean, I'm a fairly talented athlete, fairly talented intellectual, fairly talented musician, right? But there are people that are just structured differently than I am. And they're everywhere. There aren't very many of them, but they're everywhere, and they always do things nobody else can do.
You're talking about truly exceptional people. That's what you're talking about?
Truly exceptional people. You know, I just think of Jean-Claude Killy. I mean, God, he was just a skinny, and he's French. He was just like a skinny French guy, man. And he would ski like four different styles and win four gold medals, man. Like, just easily. He would just do it. And his dad was in the resistance in World War. He was just a rich Parisian kid. His dad was a lawyer.
Which is the only real way you get good at skiing.
Yeah, to Montreux and hang out, or go to Grenoble and hang out, and or Innsbruck. But his dad was in the resistance in World War II. Can you imagine what that meant? I mean, knowing that if they caught you, they'd torture you. And it made no difference to this guy. He just went in the hills and, you know, and the tuition of a resistance fighter in France was like 80%, man. It was just like as bad as anywhere, you know, with villagers, you know, giving little information. And I just kept thinking of Jean-Claude Killy, man. He's just his dad was a different guy and he was different. The whole line was different, you know. I could not do that. Just give me a gun and let me go die on the front lines, man. Just don't let me sit and wait. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's a completely different attitude.
It's a completely fucking... But people can do that. There are human beings, men and women, that can do that stuff. There's no way, man.
Wait, so you're more comfortable dying on the front lines than being a
resistance fighter? Give me a gun and go die with a few people around me, man. Don't tell me to sit around and wait for the fucking Nazis to come after me with their technical skills, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah, anyway, I don't think you would have been good in the CIA. You wouldn't have been a good spy. Yeah, God. Like you would have been a... You...
God. I would have drunk a lot. I've drunk more than I do now.
Or you would have tried to do a Roald Dahl style, sleeping with the wives of...
Stephen Curry, man. I mean, you think about it. He's sinking three throws from across the street. I mean, I can't even see that far. You know, they're just human beings that are just totally, they're structured differently than we are, man. Well, and if you groom them, if you give them the chance, but some people doesn't even matter. They just have it, and they can see how stupid everybody else is or how uncoordinated everybody else is. They just gotta like do it. Yeah. So that's my theory.
Whoa, Will's theory on sports.
Will's theory on everything. He's just another guy. He's just like that, man. And
slumping around. How can both of the examples you used were sports examples.
Right, but Feynman's the same way.
No, because intellectual processes is different than sports processes, I think. Because sports processes involves actively not thinking about something, right? Like people who are great at sports are great specifically... Well, David Foster Wallace made this point once. He said the people who, like, he was really into tennis, and he wrote an article of, like, why are all people who write autobiographical tennis books so bad at
so
telling
bad. So why boring.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so fucking boring. Yeah.
And his thesis was basically, well, in order to be good at sport, you have to shut off the part of your brain that's good at diagnosing why you're good at it.
Or you're not that very smart to begin with.
Right.
But the other thing, no, I'm saying it's something different. I mean, I think the great athletes just are different. They're the way they perceive the world, their ability to move into it, their ability to move through it, and but I mean, like I said, it just took me a long time to realize that. And Feynman, I mean, like I'm saying, man, Feynman would walk into a room with 100 people, before computers, right? And there'd be like 100 mathematicians in a room, and they're just going, geez, what is the math to get this, you know, a detonation rate with this amount of whatever, and in this amount of time, and with this, you know, with this compression, right?
Should I read that one?
Yes.
At the Princeton Graduate School, the physics department and the math department shared a common lounge, and every day at 4 o'clock we would have tea. It was a way of relaxing in the afternoon, in addition to imitating an English college. People would sit around playing Go or discussing theorems. In those days, topology was the big thing. I still remember a guy sitting on the couch thinking very hard, and another guy standing in front of him saying, "And therefore such and such is true." "Why is that?" the guy on the couch asks. "It's trivial, it's trivial," the standing guy says, and he rapidly reels off a series of logical steps. "First you assume thus and thus so, and we have Kirchhoff's this and that, and there's Wassenstoffer's theorem, and we substitute this and construct that, now you put the vector which goes around here, and then thus and so." The guy on the couch is struggling to understand all this stuff, which goes on at high speed for about 15 minutes. Finally, the standing guy comes out the other end, and the guy on the couch says, "Yeah, yeah, it's trivial." We physicists were laughing, trying to figure them out. We decided that trivial means proved. So we joked with the mathematicians. "We have a new theorem that mathematicians can prove only trivial theorems, because every theorem that's proved is trivial." The mathematicians didn't like that theorem, and I teased them about it. I said there are never any surprises, that the mathematicians only prove things that are obvious. Topology was not at all obvious to the mathematicians. There were all kinds of weird possibilities that were counterintuitive. Then I got an idea. I challenged them. "I bet there isn't a single theorem that you can tell me what the assumptions are and what the theorem is in terms I can understand, where I can't tell you right away whether it's true or false." Hmm. It often went like this. They would explain to me, "You've got an orange, okay? Now you cut the orange into a finite number of pieces, put it back together, and it's as big as the sun. True or false? No holes? No holes. Impossible, there ain't no such thing." "Ha, we got him," everybody gathered around. "It's so-and-so's theorem of immeasurable measure." Just when they think they've got me, I remind them, "But you said an orange. You can't cut the orange peel any thinner than the atoms." "But we have the condition of continuity. We can keep on cutting." "No, you said an orange, so I assumed you meant a real orange." So I always won. If I guessed it right, great. If I guessed it wrong, there was always something I could find in their simplification that they left out.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a certain amount of genuine quality to my guess. To my guesses. I had a scheme, which I still use today when somebody is explaining something that I'm trying to understand. I keep making up examples. For instance, the mathematicians would come in with a terrific theorem, and they're all excited. As they're telling me the conditions of the theorem, I construct something which fits all the conditions. You know, you have a set, one ball, disjoint, two balls, then the balls turn colors, grow hairs, or whatever, in my head as they put more conditions on. Finally, they state the theorem, which is some dumb thing about the ball, which isn't true for my hairy green ball thing, so I say, "False." If it's true, they get all excited, and I let them go on for a while. Then I point out my counterexample. "Oh, we forgot to tell you that it's a class 2 Hausdorff homomorphic." "Well then," I say, "it's trivial, it's trivial." By that time, I know which way it goes, even though I don't know what Hausdorff homomorphic means. I guessed right most of the time, because although the mathematicians thought their topology theorems were counterintuitive, they weren't really as difficult as they looked. You can get used to the funny properties of this ultra-fine cutting business and do a pretty good job of guessing how it will come out. Although I gave the mathematicians a lot of trouble, they were always very kind to me. They were a happy bunch of boys who were developing things, and they were terrifically excited about it. They would discuss their trivial theorems and always try to explain something to you if you asked a simple question. Paul Olam and I shared a bathroom, we got to be good friends, and he tried to teach me mathematics. He got me up to homotopy groups, and at that point, I gave up. But the things below that I understood fairly well. One thing I never did learn was contour integration. I had learned to do integrals by various methods shown in a book that my high school physics teacher, Mr. Bader, had given me. One day he told me to stay after class. Feynman, he said, you talk too much and you make too much noise. I know why, you're bored, so I'm going to give you a book. You go up there in the back in the corner and study this book, and when you know everything that's in this book, you can talk again. So every physics class, I paid no attention to what was going on with Pascal's Law or whatever they were doing. I was up in the back with this book, Advanced Calculus by Woods. The book showed how to differentiate parameters under the integral sign. It's a certain operation. It turns out that it's not very much taught in universities, and so Feynman had a different box of tools than everyone else.
Yes.
End of.
So it was great. Thanks, you guys, for being patient with us.
Oh, you're good. We're just
going
in the store.
Oh, great. Great, yeah. So, yeah. Another great podcast, Western Thought. Good deal. God, and they even turned the lights off, and you guys came in. See, this is called filtering. We only get the coolest people. If you turn the lights off.
Yeah.
That's great.
Six, I hope we're not too late.
Yeah, no, great. I'm glad you came in. And you saw all the codes. Yes, maybe we should. I really appreciate you guys.